Fanning. Weekends on 2FM.
Now, the song Something by the Beatles, Wonderful Tonight by Eric Clapton, and Layla by Derek and the Dominoes are all classics, and they're all connected because they're all about the same woman, Patti Boyd. She was actually married to both George Harrison and Eric Clapton. Well, her sister, Jenny Boyd, was part of all that swinging hip scene of 60s, 70s rock. She married Mick Fleetwood. She married Mick Fleetwood not once, but twice. She also married Bob Dylan's drummer. She worked in the Beatles boutique. She went with them to India to spend time with the Maharishi, and one of the biggest hit makers of the 1960s, Donovan, he wrote a song about her. It's called Jennifer Juniper. Well, so is this book I have in my hand here, Jennifer Juniper by Jenny Boyd, a fascinating account of those crazy times. 20 years ago, Jenny went on a 8-hour day walking trip to Nepal, and she met architect David Levitt, OBE, her husband for the past few decades. So welcome to the programme, Jenny. Jenny, what does a walking trip like that do for your head? I mean, were you trying to find yourself?
No, I think I was working within the addiction field at that time, and I just needed some time out, and I loved the idea of going to or seeing at the foothills of the Himalayas. And so my friend of mine said, well, why don't we go? And she was organizing it, and we had this trek up from Germany. And I had moved to England probably about a couple of years, and I was still kind of thinking maybe I'd made a mistake, maybe I'd go back to LA. Anyway, so we walked along, and hour after hour, you just walk. And it's the most amazing experience, because you don't know. I came to the conclusion, you don't know anything in life, and you all you do know is that you put one foot in front of the other, and that's how slow everything is. And so it was just, I just happened to be walking with him sometimes or somebody else, whoever was walking at the same pace as you. And I just loved talking to him. He was great. And we got to know each other slowly, but I didn't think of it as anything that would lead to anything else, because I was still thinking, well, maybe I'll go and live in back in LA. But somehow our friendship developed, and that's how it happened.
That's how it happened. And we could say in a very broad sense that he's classical and you're rock and roll. So one of those things is, do you think that this book and what you've done here with Jennifer Juniper is like that you're emerging, as we can see, from under the shadow of the Beatles and Fleetwood Mac and everybody else? But was it a question really of emerging from under your own shadow?
Exactly, Dave. That's exactly what I was thinking. It was that. Yep. And how many of us do that, where we kind of hide under our own shadow?
Okay, well, let's just take a look then at like one of the big stories, obviously, is Mick Fleetwood himself. Now, when you met Mick, you were about 15 and he was 16, and he was in a couple of bands. I think one of them was the Bow Street Runners and all that kind of thing. But he was dating your friend when you first met properly. Now, you were attracted to him, but you dated his friend, and his friend later went on to be the main guy in Pink Floyd. That's Roger Waters. Okay, give it to me right.
I was doing an article for one of the newspapers here,
yeah,
and I'd said I had this boyfriend when I was 16. His name was Roger, and they added themselves independently, Roger Waters. And so that wasn't Roger Waters at all. It was just, you know, this guy called Roger.
Oh, God. But it was Roger who got you into modeling at the age of 16.
Exactly. Just a Roger. Yep.
Yeah. And he was decorating this Carnaby Street showrooms. I mean, you know, this is so properly the centre of the world in terms of 60s, etc. And for very famous fashion designers. And what happened? Like, he suggested you be a house model, and you happened to know Vogue and the editor. And like, just tell me that story, first of all.
I was still at school, and because he was painting this showroom, Folan Tuffin, that's what the name of the designers, yeah. So they were looking for a house model, which meant you walk up and down their showroom, showing it to the people, you know, the editors of Vogue or Elle or all the different glossy magazines. And he just said, oh, my girlfriend, she'll probably do. And so he told me, I had no inkling to be a model at all. So then I came back from school one afternoon, went for an interview, and they thought I would be perfect. So I left school and just started work that Monday. But Carnaby Street at that time was pretty down and out. So that's why a lot of artists would live there, because it was cheap, the rents were cheap. And but what was happening, there were two or three men's boutiques, and that was new at that time. And what was also new is that they were blaring out fantastic rock and roll music, so you could hear it in the street. So that was that was the beginning of Carnaby Street becoming a very cool place.
And the British kind of fashion invasion of New York, it's usually the music one people talk about, but you were part of all that. You went over there. And then you and Patty, you kind of caused a bit of a stir because you were sisters as much as anything else, modelling the Mary Quant and all the rest. And David Bailey shot you for Vogue. Does that kind of, just even that photo shoot, does that elevate you to another level up the ladder?
Well, I suppose it did, but not in my mind. In my mind, I was just doing my job, you know, and this was fun and this was nice and I was young and, you know, life was opening up. But yeah, it did. So I got a lot of work as a photographic model after that.
And what about then Mick himself? I mean, like, as in Mick Fleetwood, you only decided really to finally sort of take anything from him in terms of going out with him properly when you went off to Wales with somebody else to live off grid. You hated it so much. He came. Did he come like on a, like, he's about 9 foot tall with his big long hair. Did he come on a big white horse and say, "I'm taking you away, damsel in distress"?
The knight in shining armor. Yeah. At last, finally, he arrives. But we've been going out with each other for a while before that.
Yeah.
And then I broke that one up when I decided I was going to go. And then I went to San Francisco and then I went to India. But we always stayed in touch. We always stayed in touch. And he'd take me for a little drive in his lovely Elvis car and things like this. And I often thought, oh, it'd be so easy just to be back with Mick. But I kept thinking I needed to find out more about the world and life and relationships and all that, because we were very young. And then that was when we decided, when I had this boyfriend up in Wales, and he arrived. And it was really like country-style living. We were doing what Bob Dylan, you know, was it Nashville Skyline? Remember that album? And so it was about going back to nature.
Yeah.
And that's how we were living, but it was freezing. And then Mick arrived and I realized, well, I felt more a kinship with him than I did with all these other people that I was living with in this commune. And that's when we decided that we were going to live together and be together, and then we got married.
Okay, well, just go back a little bit there, because you mentioned two things there. You just dropped things like San Francisco and India. I want to take a look at San Francisco and India here, because obviously, you know, your sister was going out with George Harrison and that was absolutely huge. So did you hang around with George and Patty much in terms of you and whoever it happened to be, maybe you and Mick?
Oh, yeah. With Mick, definitely. We'd go to clubs together and the rest of the Beatles would be there. So it was definitely, you know, we'd hang out together just like you'd hang out with your sister's boyfriend and whoever else their friends were. So I did, but we also had our own kind of life too, because Mick was playing then. He wasn't in Fleetwood Mac, I think he was Bow Street Runners then. And he would be playing in places like the Flamingo, which was a real dive in Soho. Excuse me. And the Cromwellian and all these other great clubs. So we would sort of have, it was all to do with music, really.
Oh, okay, but like, you know, you were like at the centre of the world in terms of young, hip swinging London and hanging out with the right people, etc. Pop stars, fashion designers, models. And also, there was a smattering all the time, wasn't there, of old aristocracy amongst all those people?
Yes. It's like suddenly everything was changing, the hierarchy and all that side of things. And we sort of had our own, really, it was like a counterculture. Because you would just recognize each other, even if you weren't talking to each other, you know, you didn't know each other, that there was a bunch of us that were part of that.
And you think in some ways, because, you know, your early years were pretty kind of disruptive, to say the least, in terms of the way you lived and your father and all those stories. But were Patty and George the first steadying influence on what's been a kind of a pretty disruptive upbringing?
Yeah, I think they were. I think they were. It was stability. It was something that we really needed. But when I thought about this years later, is that the kind of upbringing we had, which we were pretty feral, you know, just roaming around this place in Africa.
Yeah.
And and in a way, it was no surprise that we should be attracted to the rock and rollers, even though they were attracted to us, because we were used to, you know, we were all like kids that just wouldn't grow up.
Yeah, the funny thing is, like, you know, you weren't necessarily starstruck because this was just your life. But Paula, your half-sister, hiding behind the sofa to cut a bit of George's hair off to show off to the schoolgirls is just one of the stories you can think of, right? But I mean, like, you know, this was the height of Beatlemania. So was George like a kind of an older brother to you?
Yes, he was. He was really kind, you know, kind with information. Like, I think I mentioned it in the book. I brought out my guitar, and this is what I was given when I was like 10, because I always loved music. And he said, oh, yeah, this is the chords for Buddy Holly song. And he saw I was squinting, said, oh, you should get some contact lenses. You know, John's got contact lenses. They're great. So he was always, he was like this really lovely older brother.
And when you went to India, just to get back to that, which you mentioned earlier on, and the meditation and all the rest of it, and just it was just so every single bit of the every day was like whatever any journalist could get. It was read about by everybody back home kind of thing. Was it idyllic? And were there inappropriate advances from the Maharishi himself, which you went to see, like the famous song that John wrote, "The Sexy Sadie," which, you know, exposes the Maharishi, if you like. I mean, was it a lovely place to be?
It was incredible. I could have lived there forever. For me, it was just everything. Because in San Francisco, I'd tried smoking pot. I tried taking, you know, acid and all this stuff, kind of looking for this self-awareness. I was on a spiritual quest. But then to go to India, to go to the ashram and have our meditation, have our mantra, it was amazing. It was really incredible. And then, of course, at that time, our bungalow, because everybody sort of groups of people have their own bungalows. You know, we'd sit on the roof and George and Paul and John would be there with their guitars and just playing, strumming, coming up with new songs and ideas and everything that was going on in our life at that time. So it could be John not sleeping or Prudence or Bungalow Bill. You know, it was kind of just they were singing what was actually going on.
But also, you know, the Sgt. Pepper's album, the opening of side two in the old vinyl days, was a song called Within You, Without You by George Harrison. Did you give George, were you reading some Hindi scripts or had you got some influence on that song?
Yes. Well, I'll tell you how it happened. We would go to this friend's house, a whole bunch of us, our little gang, and we'd all sit round the table and, you know, everyone would have smoke a bit of weed and listen to just great music. And it was, music was everything. But we didn't really talk to each other because we would just sit there and listen to music. And I remember picking up this book on the table called Karma and Rebirth by someone called Christmas Humphreys. And I was just flicking through the pages and then I saw this line that said, life goes on within you and without you. And I just thought, wow, you know, that's amazing. So I called Patty and George, and George answers the phone. And I just said, listen to this. Life goes on within you and without you. And he got it as well. And then afterwards, that's where the song came from.
Like, I don't mean to be glib about decades, but do you think you could say about drugs that in the 60s, spiritual enlightenment, in the 70s, just too decadent?
Absolutely right. Yeah. It was totally different in the 70s. It was, you know, there wasn't that innocence, that idealism. It was much more selfish in a way. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, if we think about the whole Fleetwood Mac thing and when they met Stevie and Lindsay and when it all started, like all the heavy drug use, it was very creative at that time too. But I think it was a whole different vibe than the 60s.
Do you think that we were talking here about a lot of brilliant musicians, but all, well, most of them, pretty emotionally damaged?
Yeah, I think we were all emotionally damaged. You know, I think that was our attraction to each other, probably. But it was, I don't know, it was sort of still part of the journey. And I think it was very exciting and exciting in lots of ways for Fleetwood Mac then at that time, because finally Mick was getting, his dream was coming true. And, you know, he was really getting the recognition that he felt that, you know, Fleetwood Mac as a band deserved.
Yeah, the funny thing about Fleetwood Mac is people will know, like they had a first incarnation and they were absolutely huge with Peter Green out front. I mean, and then for a few years, it didn't happen too well. They were able to tour just off the name for a bunch. And then we all know what happened next. Two albums, one called Fleetwood Mac and one called Rumours. And that's when Lindsay and Stevie came in and it just changed everything and billions of sales. And the kind of lifestyle they were leading was huge news everywhere in terms of swapping partners and the madness of it all. And a lot of of drugs. But one of the things, I just want to go back to George for 1 second here, because those who know their Beatles stuff, George Harrison always said he went down the Haight Ashbury in terms of the Summer of Love, in terms of, you know, what everything was happening in San Francisco. And he said he didn't see anything about peace, love and brown rice and all the rest of it. He just saw a miserable bunch of people. He just wanted out. Now, were you the one who brought him down there?
Yes. But the thing is, when I went to San Francisco, and I only went, we didn't know about all this flower power or anything like that. And I only went because a good friend of mine said, well, would you help me open up my shop? And I just had what I'd called like a sort of spiritual aha awakening before that. So I didn't want to do modeling anymore. I wanted something with more meaning. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll either, you know, have a one-way ticket to San Francisco or 3 months rent. So I thought, oh, I'll go to San Francisco. And and it was wonderful. It was just as soon as I landed, I realized I was in a different world. And people had all had this sort of experience. And I longed for Patty and George to come and witness it, because there was people giving each other flowers along Haight Ashbury and a lot of people being creative. It was just utopia. But by the time they came, that was August. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the good hippies had gone to Marin County, Sausalito, and they were living off the land. And Timothy Leary had said, everybody's got to turn on, tune in and drop out. So all these kids came from all over the states and just hung out and just didn't do anything and just begged. And so it was a completely different scene. And I felt so responsible when we'd done the walk and all these kids were like, you know, after George and shouting and let me lay this on you and that on you. And, you know, he hated it.
By the way, we are talking to Jenny Boyd, and we're looking at the book at the moment called Jennifer Juniper, which is a story of your life, and fascinating because in one way, like, you're right in the middle of the whole thing, and yet you can almost write from the periphery in some ways as well, which is like, it's a brilliant sort of, you know, quality to be able to have, to write a book like this and looking back on all these years. One of the things is, I'm going to play a little piece of a song now, because it's the title of the book and it's very relevant to this. Is Donovan with Jennifer Juniper.
Jennifer Juniper lives upon the hill. Jennifer Juniper sitting very still. Is she sleeping? I don't think so. Is she breathing? Yes, very low. What you doing, Jennifer, my love? Rides a dappled mill. Jennifer Juniper, lilacs in her hair. Is she dreaming? Yes, I think so. Is she pretty? Yes, ever so.
There you go. Jennifer Juniper is the name of the song, from Donovan, of course, and a man who had about 400 top 10 hits between about 65 and 70. Right in the middle of all that is one of those ones, and that's that one there. And it is Jennifer Juniper that we're talking to here, because that's the name of the book as well. And Jenny Boyd, you were working in, what was it? Was it one of the Beatles shops or something in 68 or thereabouts?
Yeah, it was the Apple Boutique. We'd all been to Bangor in Wales and got our mantra and spent time with Maharishi. And Maharishi said, yes, yes, you know, he wanted us all to go to India. Well, George asked me, would you go to India with us? And he and Patty. And so while I was waiting to go to India, there was about 2-3 months. And so they'd just opened up the Apple Boutique. So they wanted me to manage it with this guy, Pete Shotton, who was one of John Lennon's friends. Oh, yeah. And it was great fun. And then one day, Donovan arrived, and I'd met him before, and we started talking about meditation in San Francisco, and, you know, he was obviously kind of on the search as well. The second time we got together, he said, I've got a song for you, and I've written a song. So I sat down opposite him, and he's looking into my eyes as he's singing Jennifer Juniper, and I was very shy at that time. I didn't quite know where to look. And also because it showed how he felt about me, and I wasn't sure, quite what was happening.
Yeah.
But I loved it. I thought it was so beautiful. And I think that song has stayed with me for over 50 years. And it's one of those songs that it feels like it's mine. But not only that, it represents that time. You know,
of course,
it represents the innocence,
yeah,
the idealism,
yeah,
we can change the world. And it's beautiful and romantic and, you know, all those things.
Well, I mean, all the stories we're talking about here now, obviously in the book, as are like, you know, you're the third of four kids. There's Nairobi in Kenya, the wealthy expat scene. Not that you were necessarily wealthy within that, you know, and a fascinating story about your dad being the handsome World War II pilot and crashed just before the wedding to your mother. And you describe him kind of as a disfigured and traumatized husband. And your mum left because of his philandering and a lot of stuff going on, basically. And then you're coming back and forth and whatever. But the point is, do you think in any way at all that, you know, that you've often found in the past that you were too largely defined by the men in your life?
Yeah, I do. It was difficult, and especially when, if I'd go, because Mick would like me going on the road with him and, you know, with the Fleetwood Mac in the early days when Peter was there and later. But it was a night, at that time we had two young children. And it was difficult because I was there because I was Mick's wife. And I didn't really chat much to the others because I didn't really drink at that time and I was shy and I was just looking, I was the mum, you know, looking after the kids. And whether we'd be driving through, you know, through different parts of America just in a car because it was, you know, everything was done on the cheap then. I just hoped that the kids wouldn't make any sound because everybody's tired. So it was... I was there just for Mick. And then after a while, hotel after hotel, I'd just have to go home. So I didn't feel a sense of my own identity for a long time, for a number of years.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, when just looking at some of the stuff that you did then and look at it now, like, you retrained as a research psychologist specializing in addiction. Do you work with that at the moment?
No, I don't. The way I used that, because I thought my original idea was that I would be a psychotherapist. I took the degrees and then I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. But the thing that I really love doing is writing. And so for my dissertation, I wrote, you know, about musicians and the creative process.
Yeah.
And then that became a book. And
a book that was re-released and updated recently.
Yes. And it's not only rock and roll. But then I worked for an addictions treatment center for, I don't know, for about 20 years, 20, 25 years. And I think it was that I kind of brought it to England, although it was American-based.
This was the Sierra Tucson treatment center.
Yeah, there was Sierra Tucson, and then there was the Meadows for a bit, but also Cottonwood. They were the longest. And I was able to do whatever I wanted. So I set up all sorts of workshops and did all sorts of things in England. You know, had this really, they really trusted me, which is very powerful if you feel you've got someone's trust, to do exactly what I wanted to do to make this thing happen. And so that's when I think I first started growing in the confidence and feeling of, you know, being under my in my own shoes.
Okay, well, listen, Jennifer Juniper is the name of the book. I just want to ask something finally about it. It's a fantastic story because it gives it all. It's all right there. And obviously, like, as you know, your sister's like has so many famous songs written about her, not just Bell Bottom Blues and For You Blue and I Need You by George, but certainly Something Supposed to Be About Your Sister by George, as in the Beatles. Also, Layla by Derek and the Dominoes, obviously, and Wonderful Tonight, both by Eric Clapton. And it's Eric Clapton I want to talk about now, because I get the impression, you know, the years you might have known Eric weren't necessarily that great, because, you know, Patty had left George Harrison for Eric Clapton, and he was basically, he drank too much, did he, most of the time that you might have known him.
Yeah, and then of course it was because Patty and I were so close at that time.
Yeah,
he and I kind of really grated against each other because he was very possessive of Patty, and so it was a sort of tricky relationship. But he was also incredibly—he could be really, really sweet and really kind, but you know, quite provoking, you know. And I'd often sometimes end up in tears, and then of course he'd put his arm around me, and so. It was sort of like a game playing going on.
Do you know, a funny thing is, even if people don't want to go back to all those years or don't know about all those years, this is a really inspirational book for those who've lost themselves in what you might call, say, codependency. But do you think finally that it is really a story of kind of a spiritual awakening and like how a woman basically overcomes all obstacles?
I think so. I would like to hope, I would hope that people, women especially, would get that message. and about, you know, just being yourself, which is what, you know, what really what the book's about. And, you know, that's the very thing that George said to me when I wanted to thank him for inviting me to India and how can I ever repay you? And he said, just be yourself.
Yeah.
And it was sort of, I realized as I was writing the book, that's it, you know, if you just be yourself.
Well, that's a good enough lesson at the moment. Well, I hope you're staying at home at the moment as we speak, Jenny, are you?
Yes, Dave.
Very good. All right, well, Jenny, it's a fascinating story for people who can, when they can get out to a bookshop. Jennifer Juniper is what it's called. It is from Jenny Boyd, and it's great. Jenny, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks a million for talking to us.
Lovely to talk to you, Dave. Thank you.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.